Is the judge unbiased and unconflicted? That box is unchecked because this judge is terrible. You know, his daughter has made almost $100 million for her clients promoting Donald Trump's indictment in this case. The judge is not fair and impartial. Former Biden administration officials who are the lifeblood in pressing these cases forward.
Voters in Denver are finally realizing that all this money that would have gone to improving their parks or increasing public safety is going to fund apartments for illegal immigrants streaming into their city. And we've got to get back to that answering the what's in it for me question for voters and not just say, oh, look, this is the top issue. Let's throw a couple words about that into the next mail or TV script.
All right, guys, a lot happening in the world of politics. Donald Trump back in court in New York. We're going to break it down with former acting attorney general Matt Whitaker. Talk about the perfect guest and the perfect day. Matt is our guy. I like to call him the Caitlin Clark of Iowa football because that's what he was. But I'll tell you more in a minute. Anyway, he's done it all. He's been a U.S. attorney. He was the acting U.S. attorney general. This is the perfect guy to break this down. Plus, brand new polling out from the firm Signal. Its president, Brent Buchanan, is back with us to give us the latest. How much is RFK going to matter in this? What are the trials doing to Trump? What are the key issues in the key states? Brent Buchanan of Signal is going to break it all down for us. Before we do that, I want to tell you a little bit about some of the two amazing sponsors that help keep this show free across platforms that you should subscribe to right now: YouTube, Rumble, Spotify, and Apple. So let's hear from them, then get into it with Matt Whitaker, former acting U.S. Attorney General. I don't mean to sound alarmist, but we know that at some point you're going to lose power, right? Maybe it's a day, maybe it's a week, a month, who knows, right? It happens all the time. Natural disasters, polls go down, things happen in this world. Maybe the power grid gets struck. Be prepared. I know I am, and I'm asking you to think about it as well. If you go to 4patriots.com/Spicer, you can get the Patriot Power Generator 2000X. I have one in my house right now. And it's so cool because the great thing about this, I've had generators in the past, but the Patriot Power Generator 2000X runs on solar panels. They come free with it, right? The panels come free with it. So you don't have to worry about gas and fumes and noise. You can put it in your house. I tested it here in my house. I hooked up my computer, my phone, a toaster oven. You can even power your fridge with the Patriot Power Generator 2000X. That's the beautiful thing about it. You can bring it in your house. You don't have to worry about gas. It's portable. If someone else needs a hand, maybe a friend or a family member, you can do that as well. Go to 4patriots.com/Spicer and you will be ready in a time of emergency and you will have all that you need, powering all those things, and the free solar panels come right with it. Go to 4patriots.com/Spicer now and make sure that you're ready in times of emergency. All right, folks, if you've had a really long day, you've been standing all day at work, you've been out doing errands, you're with the kids, maybe at a game, you know what it's like to have really tired feet. I know that feeling. I've got a solution for you. Gravity Defier shoes. These shoes are not just ordinary footwear. They're designed to provide you with the ultimate comfort and support. They've got these custom orthotics. And if you're somebody who's had foot issues before, you know how important the orthotics are in them. These all come with custom orthotics. So if you're running around in any way, shape, or form on your shoes, these Gravity Defier shoes are exactly what you need. Every pair comes with these things that are perfectly fitted. And then they've also got Verso patented shock. This is like the stuff that's in trampolines. It's in the heel to avoid important shock when you're walking back and forth. And it also helps you walk better, have better posture, taking a lot of stress that improves your calf and major muscle groups. So these shoes help you in so many different ways, but don't take my word for it. Read the thousands of positive reviews that come with this. People are experiencing less pain, walking in more comfort, have better posture. And if you use code SPICER30 and you go to GDEFY.com, you get $30 off of your first order over $150. This is just in time for Mother's Day or Father's Day. So if it's not for you and you want to give it as a gift, you got the perfect one. Once again, just go to GDEFY.com and use code SPICER30. That gets you $30 off your order of $150 or more. Matt Whitaker, good to see you. You know, I was extolling your virtues and all of your background, but I got to be honest, the one thing that no one ever brings up is that you were the, I know everyone right now wants to talk about Caitlin Clark, but when it comes to Iowa Hawkeye football, I mean, you were the Caitlin Clark of Hawkeye tight ends, right?
Yeah. I've heard that a lot, actually. I've only heard that once in my life, and it's from you, Sean. So but thank you.
Well, now you can put it down and say, was referred to as the Caitlin Clark of Iowa Hawkeyes tight ends. Because I just don't think you, of all of the legal prowess that you have, no one pays attention to the sports stuff.
That's true.
All right. Well, let's get to your wheelhouse. Let me just start with this. The people, more and more when I talk to folks, they'll say, can Trump get a fair trial in New York? From a legal standpoint, what constitutes a fair trial?
Well, first of all, you're going to start with, is the judge unbiased and unconflicted? And that box is unchecked because this judge is terrible. He has, you know, his daughter has made almost $100 million for her clients promoting Donald Trump's indictment in this case. So the judge is not fair and impartial. Is the jury fair and impartial? Well, first of all, 70% of Manhattan voted for Joe Biden. You know, 20% or so voted for Donald Trump. You're starting with a very biased jury pool. 60%, you know, Sean, this is what's missed, is they surveyed before this trial 2,000 Manhattan potential jurors, and 60% said that they felt Donald Trump was guilty before any evidence is heard, before any court was conducted. So, you know, I just don't see how Donald Trump can get a fair trial in New York on this case.
But I agree with everything you just said from a legal standpoint. So have they exhausted all of their avenues to claim that this is legal? This is not a fair trial. That's what I'm trying to get at, is that and I both look at the same thing and say, there's no way. What is the legal basis for saying that? And have they exhausted those options?
Yeah, well, so they filed a motion to move the venue to a better location, better jury pool, let's say upstate New York, where there's at least a 50-50 chance of, you know, getting half Republicans and Trump supporters, or at least people that are sympathetic to, you know, hear what he has to say. That was denied. You know, they tried to dismiss it. That was denied. You know, all of these things are obviously pending appeal, but what you're going to realize, and what I know, Sean, from trying cases both as a prosecutor and a defense attorney, is that once the gun goes off and the opening statements start and you start hearing witnesses, a lot of those arguments are kind of gone, and an appeals court is going to be very reluctant to actually reverse that judge's decision.
I'm actually glad you meant, because that's my next question, and so that's great that you addressed that. Let's go back to the judge, first of all. As you point out, the daughter is engaged. She is the president of a political firm that represents clients like Adam Schiff and sends out messages and therefore makes money saying Trump should be in jail, convict Trump, indict Trump. How is that not a conflict, that the daughter of the judge literally has a financial interest in the outcome?
Well, it is a conflict, and I've been very outspoken about this. There's two other things that we need to know about this judge. First of all, he's a Biden donor. So, you know, he clearly put his money where his mouth is. Not only did he vote for him, but he supported him financially. And the second thing that we need to understand about this judge is the daughter went on a podcast and talked about how she was talking to her dad about politicians tweeting and how, you know, he doesn't appreciate that or enjoy that. He was specifically, because of the time frame, talking about Donald Trump. And so I just think, you know, this judge has conflicts and should not be on this case, but he's clinging on to this. He also has Steve Bannon's, border criminal case as well. This is someone that clearly is ideologically bent and wants to, you know, punish Trump and his supporters.
So again, that's pretty obvious, right? In terms of his personal contributions, his daughter's relationship, who ultimately will rule whether he was conflicted or not?
Well, so there's a couple of avenues. One is, you know, the judges typically handle their own conflicts. And so there's really nowhere to appeal that decision by the judge. But, you know, there's a court of appeals in New York, and they will ultimately hear all of these issues. I think the strongest issue on appeal is this whole idea that somehow federal campaign election laws enhance these document case, you know, these alleged incorrect business documents. I think the whole thing is quite frankly weak on the law, and it will be reversed on that issue alone. And there's so many other things too.
I want to get to that in a second. It was funny, just, you know, when you were describing this, I was involved in this civil litigation matter in my town. And I remember the judge at the beginning said, hey, I want to disclose that when I was, you know, an associate at X firm, we represented a subsidiary of this firm. Does either party have a problem? And I was like, no, I don't really care, because I didn't see how it was germane or not. I'm not a lawyer, but it didn't matter. And I keep thinking about what we were just talking about, right? This judge in my case was so concerned with any perception of conflict that she was telling us her background and how she might be perceived as being conflicted. And this to me is a clear, you know, no-go zone. But I want to talk to you about the gag order before we get to the charge itself, because I find it fascinating what you brought up. So they're litigating the gag order today. And I don't, as I've always said to folks, I'm not a lawyer. And this is why I love having someone of your stature on the show. If I listen to the media now, it says Trump's attacked his family and his daughter. So I looked, and I can't say I've sent every truth that he sent out or every statement, but the ones that I found echo what you said. They remind people that she is the president of a political firm that makes money off of the outcome of this election. That's not attacking. That's pointing out the obvious, right? That's stating, giving people an understanding of what's happening. So how does that play into this gag order?
Well, the gag order is intended to do is to muzzle Donald Trump from defending himself in public and from, you know, I don't think, to your point, I've also seen what he says on Truth. I don't see him attacking. He's just pointing out these obvious biases of the judge, you know, his daughter's participation in politics, and, you know, the fact that Michael Cohen is a liar and Stormy Daniels can't be trusted either. I have been following this case probably as closely as anyone in the country. And from what I can tell, you know, this is just not an effort to somehow keep the justice system fair and to keep the jury pool from being tainted. It's actually an attempt just to muzzle the leading candidate for president of the United States.
Exactly. I mean, the thing is, everything he's saying is true. It's one thing if I call you a liar, right? And in the case of Trump, he's calling Michael Cohen a liar. And you could argue, well, that's disparaging the witness. Michael Cohen pled guilty to perjury, which is lying. I mean, those are facts. That's not an attack.
No, it just doesn't stop there. I mean, if you think about what he's doing, he is merely communicating, you know, his side of the story. And I think that every American is entitled to that, and especially a candidate for president should have enhanced First Amendment protections to speak out, especially, you know, when you have something as unfair and biased as what's going on in New York right now. We should encourage and celebrate Donald Trump being able to do that. And instead, you know, half of this country wants to, you know, never hear from him again. It's really a shame.
Yeah. So let's get to the nut of the case, which is kind of what you were getting at. My understanding, I mean, when you pick up the newspaper or go online or watch morning television, it's Donald Trump is facing these charges on federal corruption and da-da-da-da. And I go, okay, wait a second. Let's stop for a second. The incident happened in 2015, right? And it was, in all normal circumstances, a bookkeeping misdemeanor issue, meaning that they wrote it down as legal fees and the state of New York or the district attorney believes it should have been something else. Explain how it got to this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, the alleged interaction between, you know, Stormy Daniels and President Trump, I think, goes back about 18 years ago, first of all. And then in, you know, anticipation of, you know, a lot of things. And one of the, you know, is in the context of obviously the presidential election. She decides she wants to make money by telling her story. And again, he's denied that it even happened. And so that, I think that's the most interesting thing. And
so is she, right? She said,
first said it didn't happen. I mean, but obviously she's been behind the scenes, you know, churning this up. So Michael Cohen goes and enters into a non-disclosure agreement, which has happened more than this time. For a lot of reasons, you know, one is to, you know, to keep any, you know, just the embarrassment of it, but not from that it happened, but just the embarrassment of somebody alleging it happened. Because, you know, you can imagine that you're, you know, famous, you're wealthy, and you have people coming at you all the time. And, you know, typically, in order to just kind of make these go away, you would enter into a non-disclosure agreement. Otherwise, you're going to have to litigate it in, you know, the court in a very unfair press environment, as right. I would say, Sean, as you're very familiar with how awful these folks in mainstream media are. And so then, again, Michael Cohen has said that Donald Trump didn't know that he entered into this agreement. We'll see what the testimony and the evidence shows otherwise. But then Michael Cohen was paid, as Donald Trump's lawyer, a monthly retainer. And I think it's equal like $35,000 a month in, you know, every month. And those checks were signed by the president. And then those checks were entered into the Trump organization's system as being legal retainers. And then on top of all that, you know, and I hope this is convoluted, so I'm trying
to
make it clear. And then they're alleging that this was essentially should have been disclosed at the front end before the election as campaign expenses. Now, where this falls completely flat on its face, you know, is that mixed purpose expenses. Like if I buy some suits in expectation of running for office, I don't have to disclose those, and I shouldn't disclose those, and I shouldn't pay for them with campaign expenses. I use my suits as a candidate for public office, but it's a mixed purpose expense. I also wear the suits, you know, to church on Sunday. So that being said, you know, and there's other examples. There's actually a ton of examples from the Federal Election Commission. They've said that those are not campaign expenses. They looked specifically at these allegations and decided this was not a campaign finance violation. Southern District of New York, DOJ looked at it, said this is not a criminal violation of campaign finance laws. Now, why am I telling this entire, you know, kind of convoluted factual? Because at the end of the day, these business records, these altering or falsification of business records, are misdemeanor crimes. They're only enhanced, and therefore 2-year statute of limitations would have passed a long time ago. They were enhanced to a felony because of this bogus FEC violation, federal campaign finance violation. And it can't be a state violation because the state doesn't regulate presidential elections. I'll note that as well, even though they might try to make it confusing for the jury. So that enhances, since they're enhanced felonies, that's a 5-year statute of limitations. And then because of COVID, you get another year. New York extended the statute on felonies to 6 years. And that's the only way they got under this, you know, deadline. Now, you know, we can talk about this as well, Sean, but this is all being orchestrated by the Biden administration. They have sent out the individual who gave yesterday's opening remarks, was on Merrick Garland's staff at the Department of Justice before he went to Letitia James, oversaw the civil case, make sure that was going well. And now he's in the Manhattan DA's case. So there are Biden, former Biden administration officials who are the lifeblood in pressing these cases forward.
I think there's 2 points that I want to press on this. One is, you said it was when it was combined with a federal statute, but the Federal Election Commission didn't push on this right. issue. Neither did the Department of Justice, neither did the Southern District of New York, right? They all passed. So how did they get to have any jurisdiction over a federal issue that the Fed said doesn't exist?
They shouldn't. And again, it's a unique nuance of New York law that if these, you know, alleged crimes, these falsification of business records. And by the way, Sean, who owns Trump Organization? Donald Trump. And if his books and records are not accurate, who is the victim of that? Donald Trump. So, I mean, like, I have a hard time wrapping my head around, you know. Right,
so he didn't file some thing with the state of New York.
Correct.
They're saying you didn't keep your books right internally.
Right. Correct.
And, oh, by the way, the feds passed on this. But here's where I think this gets even more interesting. Alvin Bragg's predecessor, Cy Vance, the district attorney prior to him, also passed on this. When Cy Vance stepped down and Alvin Bragg took over, he initially passed on this.
Yep. And this just demonstrates not only the weakness of the case, but how Alvin Bragg has decided to just politically attack through lawfare and through completely bogus legal theory, President Trump, and keep him off the campaign trail.
So how, from a lawyer standpoint, we were talking before about the appeals process, right? So now that we're into the legal meat of this, mm-hmm. can they just argue, hey, you don't have jurisdiction. The statute of limitations passed on. I mean, do they want to get into the he said, she said, if you will, what was this payment for? And Michael Cohen's a liar. Or are they better off just arguing, you guys can't even come after us for this? Like, this is a misdemeanor offense that the statute of limitations passed on, that everyone else passed on, that the Federal Election Commission said there's nothing here on.
Yeah, and obviously they've raised all those pre-trial, and this judge has ruled against them, and you know they're saved on appeal. Where the rubber meets the road for me, and you know it's not satisfactory, is that there's ultimately going to be jury instructions that are going to say what the law is, and that's where the rubber meets the road, because you know they're going to hear all the facts, but ultimately the judge is going to instruct them as to what the law is and how they need to apply the law to the facts that they've heard at trial. And I think that's where these theories really ultimately just come in, like a car crash and a pileup, where this judge and Alvin Bragg are not going to be able to hold this theory together.
So the thing that I find interesting about this is that we keep hearing about how they combined this misdemeanor offense with a felony, right? Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong, he was never actually charged with the felony. There is no additional charge about election, you know, interference. Correct. Or election. Yeah. So how do you combine two things if one of the other things you're not actually combining it with?
Yeah, it's essentially an enhancement. It says that if you committed these falsification of business records in furtherance of another crime, this federal campaign election finance violation, then everything is a felony.
Again, but they didn't charge him. But didn't they, as far as I know, they didn't charge him with the enhanced crime. They're not charging him with a campaign finance violation, right?
Yes, but they're going to have to show that he did it in furtherance of this campaign finance violation.
But if you're saying that I did this in furtherance of a murder and I didn't actually get charged with the murder, how do you then enhance it? Because I'd say, great, then charge me with that crime, because that's the only way you can enhance it. Is this a loophole in the law?
Yeah, it's just a unique part of New York law, unfortunately, Sean. I wish I could say that somehow this is all legitimate. I mean, I don't wish I could say it, because it's not legitimate. But it just shows you how completely made up this entire case has been.
It actually scares me, in all seriousness, because I keep saying to myself, wow, if they really want to get you, they just do it and they don't care about the law. And I find myself with friends and family having conversations about this trial, and they'll say, okay, I'm not paying that close of attention, but how is this possible? Yeah. I'm like, listen, that's what the scary part about this is. One other issue that I thought was kind of petty about this is, explain to me, in a criminal case like this, like he's sitting there now for 4 hours a day, is it normal that somebody, if you're a defendant, 8 hours a day for 4 days a week, because they're letting him off on Wednesdays, is it normal that if you're tried with a crime, you must be in the courtroom?
Yeah. Every criminal defendant must attend the proceedings, and you'll see where the civil trial, he didn't have to be there as one of the parties in criminal trials. The defendant has to be there.
If you're looking for the perfect Mother's or Father's Day gift, and they're both coming up, I've got something right perfect for it. If you are looking for the perfect Mother's or Father's Day gift, and both are coming up, by the way, I've got the perfect gift for you that's going to be unique and meaningful. Trust me when I say you will be the envy of your brothers and sisters, your cousins, your aunts, your uncles, and trust me, you will see your parents hang it in their house. Check out what my friends at Paint Your Life have done. All you need to do is text Spicer to 87204 and you'll get in on what I'm about to tell you. Now, look, I took a picture of me. You can take a picture of me to give to your parents, but I think they'd probably want something of you. And you can even make it a compilation, right? So you could take a bunch of pictures and make it a family picture, maybe a pet added in. And the folks at Paint Your Life can work with you to make that the painting that you've always wanted. Acrylic, charcoal, oil, whatever it is, you get to choose that. You get to choose the frame and you get to choose the artist. And you work with that artist. They'll send you video updates on the work that they're doing. You get to fully approve it. It's 100% guarantee. And if you text Spicer right now to 87204, the folks at Paint Your Life are going to give you 20% off and free shipping. This is you don't even have to think anymore. This is it. I found my Mother's and Father's Day gift right now. This is the answer. Go right now. It's fully refundable. You get to choose the artist that you want, and you have a gift that, trust me, is going to make your brothers and sisters and everyone else envious of what you got them. Remember that message and data rates do apply. So when the first day of this went off, they said that they cut it short, David Pecker, that first day of testimony, because a juror had an outstanding obligation. But when President Trump said, hey, my son's graduating from high school, I'd like to attend it, and the judge said no, where does that fall in terms of the normal scale?
Typically, there is an accommodation that's done, not only for jurors, but for defendants and for other, you know, primary actors, whether it's the defense or the prosecution, lawyers, or even the judge. But, you know, this is, again, a whole idea is to keep Donald Trump muzzled and off the campaign trail, and he has to miss important family obligations. This judge doesn't seem to be sympathetic at all to it. It's ridiculous.
Matt, the last question I want to ask you is, there's a story out in Politico this morning that says inside off-the-record calls held by anti-Trump legal pundits. And it basically just talks about how all these pundits that are on the cable shows have been gathering on Zoom calls to strategize about basically their anti-Trump. Does that concern you at all in terms of tainting the jury pool? Because we got a taste of what these folks read and see. And if we know that all of the quote unquote media pundit lawyers are coordinating their talking points and strategy, should that be a concern to the Trump legal team?
Yes, but it also just shows you how organized the left is in their messaging. And, you know, the jurors have agreed and have sworn that they are not following the case. They don't know anything about it. They haven't prejudged it, and they're not going to pay attention to coverage. But, you know, at the same time, Sean, my experience with jurors is that they're human beings, and, you know, they have a hard time resisting something as high profile as this, not following the coverage and not seeing it. But, you know, typically, you know, and again, my experience, jurors will live up to their obligations. But, you know, we're dealing with a different jury pool, New York City jury pool, people that maybe even just stealth and wanted to serve on this jury. You saw a couple of the first early jurors, you know, kind of leave the jury, one because they didn't want this, you know, the attention. But the second one, you know, that had lied to try to get through to be on the jury. So it just is evidence that we got to watch this jury very carefully.
I'm sorry. I do have one more quick thing I want to get to, because I forgot that I'd be remiss if I don't ask this. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't have a lot of confidence that a Manhattan, New York jury is going to side with President Trump. So let's just preface that I hope I'm wrong. If I'm not, and they do convict the guy, walk me through, obviously he appeals. Is there any scenario in which the judge says, hey, you've got to go to jail, or like, what is there? Because that's what I worry about now, is that in furtherance of keeping him off the trail, they do something like this. What's that look like if this goes the wrong way?
Yeah. Typically, when a defendant is free to leave court during the trial, they don't take them in custody pending appeal. Now, we are in completely uncharted waters. And so, you know, I'd be wildly speculating to know how this judge is going to, you know, treat Donald Trump, because he's treated him unfairly so far. So I don't know why we would expect him to be fair going forward. But first of all, I just can't imagine Secret Service is going to allow Donald Trump to go anywhere near Rikers Island. But, you know, there are some scenarios here where, because of the bias, because of the Trump hatred, that somehow they, you know, they do treat him different than every other defendant in America. But, you know, I'm watching this carefully, and obviously there are people at very high levels that are thinking through, you know, some of these consequences.
I hope so. Matt Whitaker, I can't think of a better person to have today than you. Thank you for being with us.
All right. I appreciate you, my friend. Good to see you again, Sean.
All right. That was a great conversation with Matt. Now I want to figure out how much this is affecting Trump's polling in the race. Let's bring in Brent Buchanan, the president of Signal. All right. I want to welcome in Brent. Listen, the first things first, what impact are these trials really having on Trump's polling numbers?
I really thought it would not have an impact at all, and if anything, give him a new soapbox to stand on. But what's been really fascinating is that it has really kept him out of the earned media game, where he gets to control the message. And so you're starting to see Joe Biden somewhat creep back in his ballot share. It really hasn't dropped Trump's numbers per se, but it has tightened up the race a little bit, simply because Trump does not get to control the earned media narrative like he normally does. And Biden's spending tens of millions of dollars on advertising too. So let's not forget that piece.
You know, Brent, when you hear folks in the media, they love to talk about the fact that if Trump's convicted, that's going to change the dynamic. So I always wonder, are those people, were they ever going to vote for Trump in the first place, right? So who are these voters that potentially are there? And does it matter that it's the New York case first and it's about a bookkeeping thing, or do the different trials matter? Like, how do you see this playing out?
Yeah, voters really suck at projecting what their future behavior is going to be. So we always ask questions about what they've done or thought in the past, because we tend to think better about ourselves in the future. And so for that reason, I think you see these poll numbers that show 60-something percent of voters would not vote for Donald Trump if he was convicted. But honestly, there's nothing new under the sun about Donald Trump. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find a voter that you introduced a new piece of information that they said, I had no clue that Donald Trump did thought or said that thing.
So do you agree with me that most of the people that tell these public polls that it changed, that weren't going to vote for him to begin with?
Yeah, they weren't, or they were looking for some out. But at the end of the day, elections are about choices. And in this case, I know it looks like there's three, but there's really only two choices, Biden or Trump. And I think at the end of the day, they're going to make their decision based on whatever the facts are that matter most to them. And that's probably not going to be one of those facts.
So when you read these polls, we always hear about like suburban women. In the case of Biden, we're hearing some of the, in like Michigan, Muslim, Arab populations or whatever. What groups do you see, the key groups that are actually going to matter in these battleground states?
Well, I think we've beat the dead horse on the phrase suburban women, because I think it's way too broad. I mean, most people live in suburbs and more than half of voters are women. So you're talking about potentially the largest group that exists in voting. And there's a whole lot more nuance to that in that, are they married? Do they have children? You know, what's their educational attainment level? And so one group that we've been paying close attention to and have been saying really off gut more than data since the beginning of this cycle is that it's going to be a coalition of younger, you know, not these radicals protesting at Columbia that are, you know, 19 years old, but, you know, somewhere in kind of the 30 to 50 year old range of voters that are more diverse than voters as a whole. And they're lower down on the educational attainment scale. I think that's going to be probably more the key group. And those people live in the rural, suburban, and urban areas. It's kind of hard to take them and say geographically, all these people look like this because they live in a certain space. And that group right now, according to our most recent national poll, is very ticked off. They are not satisfied with the options that they have on the presidential race. When you present them the full ballot that has RFK Jr. and Cornel West and Jill Stein, they fragment. And I think Biden and Trump get like a combined 30% of the vote in that scenario, which really just tells us they're not happy. And their number one issue by far is inflation and economy. And as Republicans beat this issue of illegal immigration, I think we're just preaching to the choir there. And we really, you know, Trump and other Republicans have got to figure out how to speak to this ticked off, diverse, young, working class population of folks that are really waiting for somebody to tell them how you're going to make their life better.
So explain that to me, because I think if I'm Trump, I want to highlight both inflation and immigration and how it's changed from when I left office to what Biden's done. What would you suggest if you were advising Team Trump? Like, how do you manifest that into a different issue?
Well, it's thinking about, you know, going to the Home Depot and buying a hammer. No, nobody's going to the Home Depot and saying, okay, I really look forward to owning this hammer with a red handle and a black top. You know, what they did is they walked into that store because there was another reason they needed that hammer. They needed to put a hole in the wall, they needed to hang a shelf, and they wanted to put their kid's trophy on it. And the reason that I use this example is because when we talk about inflation, when we talk about illegal immigration, and we don't talk about the second and third and fourth order of magnitude of what is the actual problem that we're dealing with, that's the source, but that's not what's actually impacting voters. And so we've got to figure out what's the kid's trophy we put on the shelf and not talk about the hammer.
Okay, this is fascinating. What would be one of your suggestions? What should that be? Like, is it finding a solution? Is it saying, I'm going to direct the Federal Reserve to lower rates? I'm going to fire Jerome Powell. Like, is that what you're talking about? Or is there another way to say, I'm going to hire more people through the federal government? I'm going to cut taxes. Like, are you talking about like they need to give more solutions?
Well, I think that's a second order. So let's go back to illegal immigration for a second. We can talk about and show all these videos of people streaming across the border.
Right.
But until a girl at your kid's school is murdered by an illegal immigrant, like the Lake and Riley case, it has not hit home. It does not impact you personally, because voters and humans in general are asking the question, what's in it for me? How does this impact me? So if we're not answering that question, just giving the solution doesn't solve the problem. And I think if you go back to 2022 election, when we had the red trickle instead of the red wave, all we simply did in advertising was say, look, inflation's really high, and look, I'm pumping gas and it's very expensive here to pump this gas in my truck that somebody drives me around in. And there was no relatability into like, okay, how does the voter actually feel about that thing? So to your point, yes, okay, what does cutting rates look like? What does figuring out how to make mortgages more affordable?
So to the immigration issue, God forbid we never have another Lake and Riley incident like they did in Georgia. But so how do you make that personal? Everybody knows somebody who's been affected by the fentanyl crisis. Is that the answer?
I think that's a piece of it, definitely, especially if you're in, you know, the Rust Belt as an example. But there are other effects of that. I mean, voters in Denver are finally realizing that all this money that would have gone to improving their parks or increasing public safety is going to fund apartments for illegal immigrants streaming into their city. And so, you know, people are more likely to act on something that's going to protect them from a loss than it is going to help them seek gain. And so in framing these narratives, we've got to figure out, how do we show them that they have lost something and that we're going to protect them from that? And here's what we're going to do to your example of saying we've got to have some policy solutions in place too. But just to go out there and say things are expensive and illegals are coming over the border because that looks good in a 30-second TV ad just isn't going to cut it for us this cycle.
Interesting. I'm glad you're bringing this up, because I haven't seen that yet. I haven't seen anyone address it the way you're suggesting. And I hope they take it to heart, because I think the effects of it are very real. And you're right. I mean, maybe people don't see it on a personal basis, the way you're describing it, but that's part of the messaging.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I remember when John Kerry and Bush were running, and he really made this sense of fear about terrorism and in your home, and you need to be concerned, and people took that to heart. So how do we take that issue of immigration and make people realize how personal it can be?
Well, what is peak Donald Trump? Peak Donald Trump is State of the Union Donald Trump. Not because he actually followed a script, but because he told stories and he pointed to folks. And like, you could actually feel it wrench you in your gut when he would tell these stories about people, either for people that he's helped or people that have been harmed by policies that the Democrats are pushing. And we've got to get back to that answering the what's in it for me question for voters, and not just say, oh, look, this is the top issue. Let's throw a couple words about that into the next mail or TV script.
So the trials definitely benefited Trump in the primary. Do you think that it's not the case in the general, that him going out and making these comments is actually not benefiting him the same way it did in the primary?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to see what happens with this first one to really definitively point to some things, whether it's positive or negative. But I mean, what we can see is that it sidelined him.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump needs to be out and about, because he's not going to have as much money. And to your point, exactly, that it did help benefit him in the primaries of like, obviously, they're coming after this guy for a reason, and it's probably because they don't want him in office and to do the things I want him to do in office. And so if we're looking at, okay, who is this 18% of voters that are really up for grabs in both congressional races and presidential race, this ticked off, diverse, young, working class group of folks? Well, how do you frame it to them? And I think it is, look, the system is rigged against you. And I'm currently sitting in a courtroom where the system is rigged against me. And he's got to create that emotional connection with voters where they look at him and say, okay, well, he just experienced something that I feel I have experienced, and create that bond where it's not necessarily even about an issue. It's just like, we have the same world experience here.
Right. It's that personalization. Yep. There's a lot of stories that I've read in the last 2 or 3 weeks about how there's this inverse thing happening where seniors are starting to go more towards Biden and young people are going for Trump. Is that something that you're seeing, and is that a good or a bad thing for Trump?
Well, it's definitely a bad thing for Trump. So we were his pollster in kind of the final 8-week stretch of the 2020 campaign. And it's something that I kept referring to on the campaign calls as the senior ceiling, to where at the time we were saying it's probably because of his response to COVID, how he talked about it, not necessarily what he did. But they were terrified, and he was not. He was joking about it. And you've kind of seen that trend continue and really exasperate within probably the past year or so, to where what you're saying is happening, where if you're over the age of 55, you are leaning more towards Biden, towards the Democrats, you know, even at the educational attainment level, which we think is the most crucial thing in politics right now, is even non-college educated seniors are moving a bit more towards Biden or not towards Trump like the rest of, you know, folks lower down on the educational attainment scale. And I think it's, you know, what is the worldview of older folks versus younger folks? Yeah. And if you're older, you've got a house that's paid for. You've got fixed income for the most part coming in. You don't have to worry about, you know, providing for a family at that age. And all the things that are really, really tough right now in the economy and things happening in public safety are happening to people who are in those prime working ages, who are trying to raise families, trying to start families, get married. And that we're just having kind of two economies right now. I saw an article today about the luxury housing market being at an all-time high, and it just made me think, like, there are definitely two Americas right now. And if you're older or have more money, like, your life is pretty great. And if you're middle-aged to lower, you know, to younger or middle-income to lower income, like, you're really struggling.
The issue that concerns me the most going into this election on our side is abortion. I think our side has sucked in their response. I think Trump has done a very good job on how he has done it, but that's my opinion. And I think, but generally speaking, we don't have a consensus. And what really worries me is in a state where the Democrats have put these ballot initiatives on, and they've won every one of them. And then you've got Arizona where this new ruling came out. So it's the battleground states, the Pennsylvanias, the Nevadas, the Arizonas, that I really worry about how abortion is going to change the dynamic. We mentioned suburban women as a one-off, but I do think that that issue resonates with women in a way that transcends party lines. What are you seeing in this issue in terms of how it's playing out?
It is. It's not great for us from an electoral standpoint, but it's really bad in special elections and midterms because our voters now, you know, we're, Republicans are now the party of the working class, and those folks are less likely to turn out in non-presidential elections. So I actually do see a little bit of a glimmer of hope in places like Arizona and Pennsylvania, and that if you were not previously considering about voting this November in the presidential election, that's probably not the thing that's going to get you out. However, it did make a bigger impact in 2022, and I think it'll make a bigger impact in 2026 when you have lower turnout. And the delta between the lower turnout is now our voters. You know, 30 years ago, they used to be Democratic voters, and we dominated midterms and special elections. And so I think the issue is really challenging in the fact that, you know, when Roe versus Wade was decided 50-something years ago, America was much more a pro-life, if we're just trying to make this a binary construct of pro-life and pro-choice. But culturally, we're in a post-Christian era and have been for decades. And so to come in and say, you know, we should make abortion illegal, which is, you know, if you look at where most voters stand, there's very few left in that camp. But for those who are true pro-lifers, that's where they are. And so it's kind of this dichotomy of the political reality versus your personal beliefs as a candidate. And, you know, it creates a challenge. But then you can also go look at Governor Brian Kemp in Georgia, who is extremely pro-life, signed a heartbeat bill at 6 weeks, and dominated in his election in a midterm. And so the last thing you want to do is waffle on the issue, because I do think voters see that as disingenuous. But I don't have an answer that's like, here's the silver bullet, say this thing, and we can deal with the abortion issue, win on the issue, but also win the election. And I think that's kind of where Republicans are right now, is balancing between those two things.
Yeah. Well, I do think that you're right about Kemp. I mean, he talks the talk, he walks the walk, and he won. The last question I want to ask you is this. What should, as RFK gets on more ballots, who is he going to affect more?
Well, right now, I would say he's affecting Biden. But if we look at, okay, who is this voter group that we've identified, these ticked off, young, diverse, working class folks, They're currently giving a little bit more towards RFK, and not necessarily more at Trump's expense than Biden's expense. But what I think the calculus becomes as we get closer to Election Day is that those voters would be more likely to vote for Donald Trump. And if he can't reach that group of folks, they're going to cast a protest ballot with somebody else in a third party, whether it's RFK or somebody who already has ballot access like a Jill Stein. And so it's not the traditional place we find ourselves, like in a, you know, a Ross Perot 92 or even a Jill Stein 2016 election scenario. It's like there's this group that could be voting Republican. But right now, we haven't earned their vote yet. And that's the group that I think is the one who goes to the RFK Jr. simply out of protest at this point.
Well, I think the warning that you're issuing is correct. We need to be aware, like not think it's a given that it's going to hurt Biden. And we need to be on this, just like the abortion issue. Understand that this is big, it's volatile, it's dynamic, and we need to take it seriously. Brent, I always appreciate you sharing the insights that Signal has with us. It's super important as we get going forward. And obviously the next time you come out of the field, please come back to us so that we can share those results with everybody. I appreciate you joining us today.
Hey, thanks, Sean. Always good to be on.
You bet. All right, guys, we're going to have more of this week. We're going to continue to cover the Trump trials, where things are, who's up, who's down. So much going on. And plus what's happening in the House of Representatives with Mike Johnson and Marjorie Taylor Greene. Be sure to subscribe, Rumble, YouTube, Spotify, Apple, I don't care where, do them all. And we'll see you tomorrow back here on the Sean Spicer Show.